Chapter 12. London, April 1940.
Fifth column, war opens here. Town bombing, hint by Nazis. Daily Mirror. Miss White, I must say, when I placed an advertisement for a teacher of French and German, I did not expect to receive an application from you.
After Miss Doncaster held out her hand and invited Eleanor to be seated, she wondered if her old teacher would add, of all people, to the stilted welcome.
Sophia Wallace, now Hunt, sent me the details, Miss Doncaster, she said. We're still in touch. She'd seen the advertisement in The Lady and thought it might suit me, given my planned return to England.
Eleanor rubbed the palm of her right hand across the top of her left hand.
I know I was probably not the easiest pupil in your charge, but coming here from Belgium in the midst of war was difficult. A troubling transition for a young girl. I'm afraid I didn't rise to the occasion terribly well while in class.
Eleanor still felt a certain awkwardness when using English locutions, a manner of speaking designed, she thought, to give an impression of respect that she didn't always feel. There were words that seemed to be used to emphasize an emotion, and thus to bolster the speaker's case or their contrition. Terribly, awfully, I'm terribly sorry, I'm awfully pleased to see you. In Eleanor's estimation, awful was awful, as in terrible, and then there was dreadful. After a few months in London, she decided such words rendered the speaker nothing less than obsequious, and should therefore be avoided.
I'm dreadfully proud of my daughter,
Charlotte had exclaimed during Eleanor's entrance interview for St. Joseph's. Eleanor thought her mother might as well have declared that she found her daughter dreadful, and wondered if she would ever be awarded a place based upon her mother's entreaty. It would not have surprised her had Charlotte said something about being absolutely dreadfully proud. After all, since the return to England, Eleanor sometimes thought her mother had become another person, at times almost a stranger.
She's devolved into being English again, Cecily had observed.
When she was 17 and preparing to leave St. Joseph's, Eleanor had wondered if this way with language helped gird Charlotte to put her foot down, countering her younger daughter's future plans.
I'm dreadfully sorry. I simply cannot countenance my daughter going off to Cambridge when we absolutely need her at home.
Eleanor was sure Charlotte was not as dreadfully or simply anything as much as she herself felt absolutely awful, terrible, dreadful, when it was clear she could not take up the offers from the universities of Oxford and Cambridge, and would instead be stuck in London when she wanted so much to be on the move, to run in case fate found her. She wanted to be among people who would never know her past. In London she had felt like prey, without a safe lair in sight. Miss Doncaster, now headmistress of St. Joseph's, clasped her hands on the leather-topped desk. Although the woman had aged, it was clear to Eleanor that she had retained her bearing, as if early lessons in deportment had remained with her, so neither grief, loss, nor fear had the strength to cower her, to round her shoulders or diminish her step.
Miss White!
Eleanor, she smiled, you were an excellent student, and you have made a very good account of yourself. I am proud of all of my girls. Sophia has done incredibly well, and you are her equal, though in a different sphere of endeavour.
Doncaster paused, sighed, and leaned back in her chair to stare out of the window, as if deciding how to voice thoughts that had come to mind as she prepared for the interview. She turned to Eleanor again.
Our girls are quite a different breed now, you know. The years since you graduated university and went on to further study in Paris have been somewhat tumultuous for the young. Admittedly, no more than it was for you, or even in my day, but all the same giving rise to an element of doubt, of unknowing that can in turn lead to undesirable words, thoughts, and actions. There have been good times and bad. Some of our pupils are the daughters of bankrupt men and women. And I don't mean bankrupt only in a financial sense, I'm sorry to say. The years after the war changed our society, and that is reflected in the attitudes and behaviours of our young women. as their teacher, you are here not only to ensure that they are proficient in two languages, and by the way, I'd like to see another romance language added to the curriculum. Italian comes to mind. As I said, you are here to do more than teach languages. You are to uphold a strong moral code and to support the standards impressed upon your pupils by the school, principles that will become the backbone of everything they do in life. Every single decision. I have found that when one remains true to one's established values, life's squalls, storms, and doldrums become easier to navigate. Does this mean, Miss White? I really do not need to extend this interview into the afternoon. I am a woman of resolute decision, and I am delighted to offer you the position. You will begin your tenure at St. Joseph's when the girls return to school for the beginning of the summer term. You will teach French and German language and literature to the girls in both the lower and upper schools. As I said, I'd also like to see Italian added to the curriculum. Miss Doncaster placed a pair of spectacles on her nose and studied the notes in front of her. Ah, good. You have also taught Latin in a previous position. She regarded Eleanor again. Such a fundamental lesson for our girls. They think Latin is ancient history, but as time marches on, they will understand the value of at least 1 year of that remarkable language. We begin instruction in the second year, which we have found is a perfect time for such immersion. Yes, of course. Regarding the timetable, Miss Doncaster, My secretary will give it to you on the way out, along with your contract and other documents requiring your signature. Of course. Eleanor came to her feet and held out her hand. Miss Doncaster smiled as she returned the grasp. You know, Miss White, I rather admired your pluck when you were in my class. Pluck? People don't use that word much anymore. But I like to see it in a young woman. I don't care for disrespect, and I will use my cane across any girl's palms for a display of outright insolence. But pluck is something quite different. It shows resolve, and is a hallmark of resilience. We are at war again, Miss White, and our women in the making will need such qualities to see them through. Eleanor smiled, ready to leave the interview. Oh, by the way, I really should have queried this earlier because it's such a crucial point, but even though your interview has taken place here in London, I hope you understand that now the school has moved, we are situated in Surrey, just outside Reigate. All the pupils are required to be boarders and will be so until it is safe for the school to return to our London premises. When I expect some to revert to being day pupils. Reigate is not terribly far on the train, and if you do not wish to commute, then rooms will be provided for you. In fact, we need a housemistress for the Jane Eyres. I think you were with the Lorna Doones, weren't you? Doncaster rubbed her forehead. I really should have said something at the outset to ensure you were able to leave London. I'm dreadfully sorry. Eleanor stifled a laugh upon seeing Doncaster so contrite. That's perfectly all right, Miss Doncaster. I was aware of the school's move, and yes, I would be delighted to take you up on the offer of rooms, though I would appreciate permission to return to visit my family from Saturday afternoon until Sunday evening. Excellent! Then everything is settled. Welcome back to St. Joseph's, Miss White. Doncaster gave Eleanor the broadest smile she had ever seen expressed by her former teacher. Now then, Miss Harding, my secretary, is waiting in the office with your employment contract and timetable, plus the languages curriculum adhered to thus far. Please inform me of any suggested alterations within the week, along with your reasons for making those changes. In addition, I would suggest you visit the temporary school before term begins. It's a rather lovely and very grand estate close to Reigate Hill. There's a stables, too, which some of our more accomplished horsewomen have very much enjoyed. The whole estate was mothballed when war was declared, and the family departed for their equally large estate in Scotland, but, as luck would have it, the lady of the house is a St. Joseph's old girl, so the entire property was offered to us, free of charge. I would add that we're asking the girls to be as careful as possible, as the school will be responsible for any necessary restorative work when we return to London. I dread the thought of holes in walls or broken chandeliers. I'm just thrilled to be joining your staff. Thank you, Miss Doncaster. I'll journey down to Reigate tomorrow to view the school.
Good. I'll see you there.
I'll be in situ when you arrive. Miss Harding will provide you with the address and everything you need to know. You should find out which train she's catching. You can travel down together.
Eleanor smiled again, but as she was about to turn and depart the office, she stopped and turned to her former teacher.
Oh, Miss Doncaster, by the way, I was with the Catherine Earnshaws, not a member of Lorna Doone House. So was Sophia.
Doncaster nodded.
She's a good friend to have, and I believe the connection was beneficial for the two of you, given all that had come to pass for you and Sophia during the last war. And you were both very good at mathematics, though I will say Sophia excelled at her number work in the way you eclipsed everyone when it came to your innate ability with languages.
There was a pause while Doncaster regarded Eleanor as if to gauge her integrity.
Miss White, Eleanor, a word of advice for you. I know you were close, but don't ask Sophia about her work, will you? She can't tell you, and it would put her in a compromised position to be questioned about it.
Eleanor was surprised at the warning.
Do you know? Remember, I am a mathematician too. During a time of war, the government cannot afford to let talent remain unused, whether the gifted are women or men, or indeed whatever their station in life might be.
Another pause.
And I like to think all my girls leave St. Joseph's accomplished in at least one useful skill. Yours is languages.
She tapped a buff-coloured folder on the desk,
which is why I will be retaining all other applications for the post I have just offered you. I fear I may be required to study them again sooner rather than later.
The first month at St. Joseph's in Reigate allowed Eleanor little time for reflection on her decision to return to England, though to her surprise she found she did not miss Paris. As April cantered into May, the threat of Hitler's army reaching the French capital loomed, and Charlotte's demand that she return home to London had seemed more prescient. Eleanor was glad she had acquiesced. The Surrey Hills provided solace for Eleanor, who had taken to riding out across the North Downs on a Saturday following her final class of the week, which was to introduce a class of 12-year-old girls to the study of Latin. It was their last lesson of the academic week, so Eleanor's classes were light-hearted in nature, and usually began with a humorous poem she had translated into Latin and required the class to translate back into English. Once she had their attention, learning could ensue, though the speed with which the girls departed the classroom indicated that Latin might well be deemed useful by Miss Doncaster, but not by the second-year pupils. A groom who had remained at the estate to care for the owner's horses had Jasper tacked up and ready for Eleanor when she arrived at the stables.
There you are, Miss White. I'd say he's raring to go today, but watch the footing on account of that rain we had last night.
I'll look after him, Dave, don't you worry,
said Eleanor, stepping up onto the mounting block.
Dave held on to the reins until Eleanor was seated.
Off you go then, Miss White. See you in a couple of hours.
Eleanor had set off at a walk toward the archway leading away from the stable block, in the direction of a bridle path that she planned to follow up a hill, then onto the North Downs, when she was stopped by Miss Doncaster, who called out and waved to her as her pace became a determined trot from the main house.
Miss White, Miss White, a moment, if you please.
Eleanor turned Jasper in the direction of the headmistress and was about to dismount in order to conduct a respectful conversation when Doncaster shook her head.
No, stay where you are. You deserve your ride across the downs. I just wanted to let you know of an adjustment to your Monday PM timetable for the next 3 weeks.
An adjustment? Doncaster looked up at Eleanor, then around her.
Perhaps you better get off that horse. Young girls love to eavesdrop, and I can never be sure where one or two of them might be hiding on a Saturday afternoon.
Eleanor dismounted as Miss Doncaster came closer.
Miss White, given the increased preparations for an invasion by the Germans, it appears we must consider how we might best protect our charges in the event of an incursion into the grounds by the Nazis.
Eleanor nodded.
I see. Yes, indeed, there should be a plan in place. The girls already demonstrate a remarkable sense of calm when we have to go down to the cellars at the sound of the air raid warnings, so I am sure they will take well to drills in case of invasion.
Indeed, yes, but this is something else.
Doncaster looked around her once again.
Truly, Miss White, I will be honest. I cannot believe I am going to ask this of you.
Please go on, headmistress.
I have selected 4 members of staff to learn how to use a gun.
Doncaster cleared her throat as if the word gun was so distasteful to her that she could not digest what she had said and might choke at any moment.
The owner of the house has a gun room. As soon as the school moved in, I had the sign removed and ensured that the door was always locked. However, upon advice from the local constabulary and home guard, we will be making the weapons inside. She coughed again. We will be making the weapons inside available to the 4 teachers I've selected to practice marksmanship. The gamekeeper, Mr. Jessop, has offered to teach you. He's also a member of our home guard, and I should let you know he's a crack shot. He was what they called a sniper in the last war, and was also decorated for valour.
Doncaster gave Eleanor a broad, though forced, smile.
So, Monday it is. Meet him by the kitchen doors after lunch. To be perfectly honest, you will need a meal in you to have to do this most unladylike.
There was a pause.
Now then, let me hold on to the opposite stirrup so you can mount up again.
Eleanor trotted out of the gate and onto the bridle path. Jasper was hot to go, so as soon as they reached the wider path, Eleanor let him have his head, galloping across the downs until they reached woodland, where she brought him to a trot, stopping at the place where a marker signalled the very spot where a hunter had fallen from his horse decades ago. And, as Dave had informed her, they planted him head first where he landed.
"They should have planted me when I landed," said Eleanor aloud. She dismounted, leaned into Jasper's neck, and shed tears of frustration. She did not want to take up arms. She did not want to go on a target practice jamboree with 3 other teachers, and she knew only too well that if there was a Nazi invasion, 4 teachers among a school of girls had better have more creative ideas up their sleeves to protect them all. As Eleanor became calmer and wiped her cheeks, she realized she had not wept since Belgium, not since the day she accepted the truth that her father had died. She had never once broken down, unlike Cecily, who had snuffled into her pillow every night for weeks after their arrival in London. She dried her tears, took a deep breath, and, stepping up onto the trunk of a fallen tree to give herself a few more inches of purchase, slipped her foot into the stirrup to take her place in the saddle again. She continued on at a walk. The horse seemed just as happy to amble after the long gallop, though she would give him 1 more canter before easing into a trot, and another walk to cool down before she handed him over to Dave. Then she would look for Mr. Jessop. The gamekeeper's beamed 16th-century cottage was set among trees at the far end of the estate. A wisp of smoke rose from the chimney, and even from some yards away, Eleanor could smell the aroma of baking. Had Mrs. Jessop managed to obtain the ingredients to make her own bread? On the other hand, if anyone could use the black market to his advantage, it would be a gamekeeper.
"Hello, Mr. Jessop," said Eleanor when the gamekeeper answered her knock. "I wonder if I could have a word with you? A private word?"
"Let me just get my cap," said the man,
who looked to be in his 50s, though Eleanor thought he might have been younger. A life spent outdoors, with his face exposed to the elements, had left Jessop with skin that mapped the trials and tribulations of a life that was far from easy. Jessop walked with Eleanor, listening to her with a hand cupped around his ear, testament to hearing compromised by years of proximity to guns, especially heavy artillery during the last war.
"So, if you don't mind, I'd rather not attend the lesson. However, if you allow me to do so, I will demonstrate that I can use a gun, and then you can let the headmistress know, so that will be the end of it."
Jessop nodded.
"Where did you learn?"
"You know what they say, Mr. Jessop,"
Eleanor smiled at the man beside her.
"Ask no questions, hear no lies."
"Right you are."
He touched his cap with 2 forefingers in an informal salute of understanding.
"You wait there a minute."
Eleanor leaned against a tree, the late spring sunlight filtering through the canopy of branches above with a welcome warmth. Until that point, she had been freezing cold. Jessop approached again, a sack slung over his shoulder.
He pointed to a path leading into woodland and instructed her to follow him, stopping in a clearing where a makeshift target practice had been set up using fencing and bottles.
"Let's try you with the Webley first," he said.
Eleanor had not handled a weapon since Belgium. She fought to keep the image of lifting her gun toward two German soldiers, seeing them fall, running with Cecily, dragging her by the scruff of the neck because at first her legs would not move. Instead, she envisioned Isabel at her side, felt her position, her hands around the gun, heard her voice, the instruction to brace, to use her core. "I will not be prey. I will not be prey. I will not be prey. I am the predator."
"Where did you learn to shoot like that, Miss White?"
"What?" said Eleanor.
"You just emptied the Webley, and you got every single bottle, and I deliberately stood you back here, not close."
Eleanor nodded and handed back the Webley.
"Can you do this with a rifle?"
"Yes." Jessop rubbed his chin as he dropped the gun into the sack.
"How old were you in the last war, Miss White?"
Eleanor stared at him, then looked away.
"I thought so," he added. "Too bloody young. Come on, the missus has just done a bit of baking. You'll come in for a nice cup of tea."
"I must be on my way, Mr. Jessop. I return to London on Saturday afternoons, you know, to see my family."
"Mother and father still alive?"
"Just my mother, and there's only the four of us. My gran, my mother, and my older sister, Cecily."
"Right, well, I'll let Miss Doncaster know you passed the test with flying colours."
He paused, his grey-blue eyes staring at Eleanor.
"You're a blooming good shot, Miss White. No doubt about it."
Despite the fact that war was ever-present, that air raids and drills were part of life at the school, Eleanor valued the daily rhythm her position provided. She had been drawn to teaching because it was a profession with an anchor. Timetables, curricula, terms, examinations, rosters and rotas. Christmas, Easter, summer. Every hour mapped out for every single day of every single week. Homework, bedtime, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Then Saturday Latin, followed by a ride into the hills on Jasper, and back again before running for the 5 o'clock train into Victoria. Grandma sleeping away her days, Charlotte cooking, complaining, chivying her along, and Cecily resigned, but now at least conversing about books, about her work at the library, about the light romances, so-called literature flooding the market, cheap escape in a paperback book to take to the shelter. Eleanor did not argue. She drew back and never crossed her sister to press the point that perhaps people needed light at a time when death was raining down from above. Perhaps there was something to be said for stories of sheiks running away with princesses or doctors falling in love with nurses and vice versa. She tried not to rise to a row with Cecily. There was enough war everywhere without a battle across the no-man's land of the family dinner table. A term passed. Then another. Home for Christmas, down to the shelter, up from the shelter. London was a life spent waiting for the all clear, the second siren letting people know the bombers had gone, so they could emerge from their underground lairs like rabbits seeking sunshine. Soon, January 1941 hove into view. Then February, March, and before long, it was Eleanor's one-year anniversary at the school, though she elected to remain at the estate with only a short visit to see Grandma Charlotte and Cecily for Easter. Yes, that would be best. She would go up to London on Thursday, April 10th, and return to Reigate on Tuesday, April 15th.
"London bombed for 6 hours. Casualties not counted in the hundreds," City Gazette.
In years to come, Eleanor would never quite find words to describe how she felt that day, the day before Good Friday, when she boarded the train bound for Victoria to spend the holiday in London with her family. There came a point during the journey when she knew she had to make her peace. It had seemed the best time to start pulling the White Ladies together again, and after all, wasn't Easter the celebrated anniversary of new beginnings, of resurrection? Yes, she would take the lead. She would not allow Cecily to bother her, even if her sister was spoiling to create discord. She would put her arms around her beloved family, bringing them close together once more. Because even though in 1917 they had arrived in London to the cocooned comfort and safety of a welcoming house, in truth, the chaos of war
had splayed them apart, had removed the glue of familial connection. Sometimes they could not even hold a conversation over dinner without an argument. How many times had her grandmother walked out of the room saying, "I'll leave you three to it"? It would not happen again. The love between them had not been enough, but Eleanor knew it was well past time for her to gather her family in her heart with compassion, for her to be steadfast in her care for those who shared her blood. Charlotte's anxiety having escalated during their escape from Belgium had never quite abated. She coddled Cecily, indulged her nerves when in male company, which was rare anyway. Eleanor knew that Cecily was caught in a vicious circle of behaviour, but over the years she could only manage her own survival. Now, filled with empathy, she acknowledged that perhaps she might have invited Cecily to Paris, offering encouragement and opportunity as she eased her sister into a life independent of Charlotte's apron strings. She could have aided her as she slaughtered her demons and banished her fears, because Cecily surely continued to feel the terror of attack in the same way Eleanor saw a shattered, bloody skull lit up by a torch every single day. Yes, she would make amends. She would help dear Ceci cross the bridge into a better future. They might be older, but it wasn't too late. At first, the journey to London was uneventful, but somewhere in the region of Croydon, the train halted. A guard came through the carriages, informing passengers that they were being held up as a precaution due to a daylight raid by German bombers. The heavy lumbering angels of death had approached the capital from the east, the Thames once again pointing the way to the docks and the city, then onward to the West End. The train would commence the journey as soon as they received the all clear. Eleanor was used to interrupted journeys, so she took out a book she was considering for her third-year Italian class. In time, the train moved on, and at Victoria, all seemed calm. From there, she ran to the tube. She had promised to be home for tea, but began to worry when there was a delay at Tottenham Court Road station. She decided to walk the rest of the way. The house was not too far from Brunswick Square, so it was easy enough, 15 minutes at her usual clip. Her grandparents had moved into the house soon after their marriage, helped by family money. Charlotte had been born in the first floor bedroom, and it was where she had brought her own daughters home to safety from Belgium. Yet as Eleanor came closer to the family home, she began to slow her pace. A feeling of dread seemed to envelop her. Approaching the street, she was aware of an escalation in activity, of people rushing to and fro. There were sirens, fire tenders, police vehicles, bells ringing, air raid precautions men pointed here and there, while firemen directed hoses at burning buildings. Stepping over fallen masonry, she saw the women's voluntary service van opening up, ready to provide tea, cakes, and sympathy. She stopped walking, not knowing quite what to do. She knew then, even before turning into the street where her family lived, before dropping the bag holding fresh hot cross buns from Mrs. Jessop, unmarked papers from the Latin class, a book for Cecily, and new embroidery silks for Charlotte. She knew they were gone. "Are you sure you don't need a little more time, Miss White? You've endured a terrible shock." Miss Doncaster regarded Eleanor as she poured more tea. They were in Doncaster's private rooms. Eleanor shook her head. "No, work is really the best medicine, Miss Doncaster, though I appreciate the offer." She lifted her cup from the saucer. "Teaching gives me a framework, a daily round. It's my mainstay, and I don't know what I would do otherwise, to be perfectly honest with you." Perhaps she should have said awfully honest, dreadfully honest, or crushingly honest. She wanted to use the most mournful adverbs, even if she had to invent them. Deathly honest. "Right you are, but do let me know if you change your mind. Arrangements can be made." The headmistress paused. "You know, I have a sister in Cornwall, if you wanted—" "That's very kind of you, Miss Doncaster, but I promise I will be all right." "Of course. Now then, in the vein of carrying on, do tell me about your new ideas for the sixth form French conversation classes." Hacking out on Jasper had become balm for Eleanor's soul. The lighter evenings gave her an opportunity to ride after classes ended for the day, and now she had nowhere to go in her free time. Soon, Saturday and Sunday afternoons, she discovered new bridle paths, fresh places to explore from the estate. She was often away for hours, losing all sense of time. Jessop had come to her aid, too. He hailed her from his cottage as she was trotting toward the path one Saturday afternoon, removing his cap when she approached.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Jessop."
The man nodded.
"Head above water, Miss White."
Eleanor looked down at the man and saw pity in his eyes.
"Yes, I think so, Mr. Jessop."
There was a pause, and Eleanor wondered if he was going to say more, and whether she should thank him for asking, wish him a good day and ride on.
"You know, Miss White, I reckon sometimes we have to get rid of the big black hole right in here."
He put his hand against his middle.
"You can't have that filling up space in there, because if it doesn't get out, it can take you down. Grows like a cancer. That's what anger does."
She stared at him.
"So what I do," continued Jessop, "I take my gun and I go into them woods and I shoot them bottles time and time again until there's nothing left of them."
He sighed and kicked against a stone.
"You can come and take one of them guns any time you want. You put as many bullets as you like into those bottles and you kill the demons one by one. If you let them take you down, they swoop in again and they won't let up. I know that because of how I came home from Flanders after the last war. Don't let them Nazis beat down your heart. Never let them win."
He lifted his cap and put it back on his head.
"And anyway, you never know when you might be grateful you kept your hand in. I'll bid you good day, Miss White."
"Good day, Mr. Jessop."
She turned Jasper away from the cottage but looked over her shoulder and called out,
"And thank you, Mr. Jessop, very much."
Cantering up Collie Hill, Eleanor brought Jasper to a halt at the Inglis Memorial, a folly affording views across the land. People said there were military goings on in the area, though Eleanor did not care to look for anything untoward. She had never seen activity that might concern her, so she remained in place for a while, pulling up Jasper so he didn't eat the grass.
"If your bit is mucky with green slime, when we get back, Dave will never let us out together again."
She leaned into the horse, who of late seemed to know her despair and tolerated the weight of her against his neck. She hoped he didn't sense her anger, because Jessop was right. There was a fury inside she could feel as if it were a ball of hot coals. At times she could even rest a hand on her ribs and feel the heat pressing back against her fingers. With one final look across the downs, she picked up the reins and trotted back to the stables.
"I was about to send out the cavalry for you, Miss White," said Dave,
holding on to Jasper's reins as Eleanor dismounted.
"You know I'll be all right, Dave. Unless Jazzy gallops home alone, then you can come out to find me. Sure I can't rub him down and put him away?"
"I like to do it myself, Miss White, though I'm not disputing your ability."
Eleanor pulled two sugar cubes from her pocket.
"Wasting good sugar on a horse," said Dave.
"I don't take sugar in my tea, so I sneak some out for this boy. He deserves it."
"Won't argue with you there. Oh, I should have mentioned it first, but a lady came along a little while ago looking for you."
"Me? Was it one of the parents?"
He shook his head.
"Well, I don't think so. And I don't think she went to the office first, either. I reckon she came here directly, so she must know you ride on a Saturday afternoon."
Perhaps it's my friend Sophie. Any idea where she went?"
The groom turned and pointed toward the wood.
"You know that bench just inside the wood, near the pond? The one with the brass plaque with a name on it? Mr. Waters, the owner of the estate, had it put there in memory of his sister who died young. Well, when the lady told me she didn't want to wait over at the manor house, I told her that if she had time to hang on for a bit, until you came back from your ride, that bench was as good a place to sit as any on a lovely day like today."
"I'll go over there now. Thank you, Dave."
Eleanor turned and walked along a path that led to the bench where a woman she knew very well would not be Sophie waited for her. Sophie would have paid a visit to Miss Doncaster if she had to linger for a while. As she came closer, she could see a woman with short, dark hair, wearing a tweed jacket and brown trousers. She had no doubt the woman's footwear was suited to walking across a field, and even from a distance she noted the fine ribbon of smoke from her cigarette. The woman did not wave when Eleanor approached, nor did she come to her feet. Instead, she tapped the place alongside her on the bench.
"Hello, Eleanor. It's been a long time, hasn't it? You've grown into quite an accomplished woman."
Eleanor nodded.
"What are you doing here, Isabel?"
"Claire Fields, actually. It's Commander Claire Fields, and I think you already know that name, don't you? I hope recognizing me at the palace hasn't bothered you too much over the years."
She sighed, shrugged, and gave a wry smile.
"Sadly, Isabel had to die in 1918, poor woman."
She flicked her cigarette down at her feet and ground it into the earth with the heel of her stout brown walking shoe.
"Well, Claire Fields, sorry, Commander Claire Fields," said Eleanor, feeling the knot in her stomach become tighter.
"Let me ask again, why are you here?"
"I'm here to give you the opportunity for revenge, Eleanor. Because, as good old Lord Kitchener said in his finger-pointing way last time we were in this sort of pickle, your country needs you."
Eleanor shook her head and stood up. "No. With respect, Commander Fields. No." Fields came to her feet and held out a hand to Eleanor.
"You don't mind if I try again, do you, Linny? It's not often someone with much-needed skills turns down an opportunity to serve their country when the chips are down."
She smiled.
"I know you. You'll do the right thing eventually. Until the next time, Miss White."